Chavez. Ruben Nava. And Jesse Romero. Jesus 911.
Soul Patrol, Jesus 911, two-man car, Jess Romero, Dr. Dan Schneider. We're here to help people love God, save souls, and slay error. Dan, hope you had a great weekend. I sure did. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad. I'm going to have Dr. Dan Schneider. He's going to walk us through. All of you have watched the movie. Most of you have watched the movie Linda Blair, with Linda Blair, The Exorcist, back in 1973. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to assume that Linda Blair contacts the Catholic Church on her own. And let's say Dan Schneider is, he's the contact person in this instance, and he's the assessor. So I'm going to want Dr. Dan, to walk us through the essential phases of a protocol that a potentially possessed person, what we call an energumen, if a person suspects they're diabolically afflicted, John Doe or Jane Doe, so they contact the Catholic Church, say they contact Dr. Dan Schneider, and Dr. Schneider obviously wants to make sure that they're part of a parish, that the pastor's notified. And so, Dan, when somebody starts off requesting help from the church, they're called a petitioner. And instead of just sending them to maybe some Pentecostal Protestant group to lay hands on them and pray over them and pray imprecatory prayers over them to make them feel better, your model is you use this intense monastic prayer life to put this petitioner. So walk us through, Dan. Jane Doe, diabolically afflicted, comes in contact with you. Let's just say she's got all her sacraments. And there's evidence that she's diabolically afflicted. Walk us through the stages, Dan.
Yeah, the opening, the contact the diocese. The diocese will contact the a director, program coordinator, and case manager for the diocese. As a step backwards, they're working. Normally, the bishop, by canon law, and it doesn't happen all the time, but normally the bishop mandates an exorcist, and the exorcist will give a letter of commissioning to the team members. So they're working under the spiritual protection of the local bishop. That's first and foremost is important. We're not just going to run in, Tuesday night prayer groups just because of the danger of that. So we're working specifically for under the direct authority of the local bishop. They'll pass to mandated by the bishop. So everything's working under complete authority. And then the question usually is, what do you want from the church? What are you asking of the church? Whether you state it that way or you listen to them. Normally what they want at this phase, this is why the name we usually refer to as a petitioner. They're petitioning something from the church. What is that? Oftentimes that is, I want to sleep at night. I want to see an exorcist. I want to be freed of the diabolic affliction. You do a quick assessment. The model is much like a medical model. And you do a quick assessment of what's going on. And then they send them back on their own for a 30-day prayer regimen. And specific prayer regimen based upon their sacramental orientation. And so they'll go back for 30 days. And the reason the regimen is important is because we've worked in other models where, the person comes in, they're not in a state of grace, you start praying for them right away. And oftentimes they're retaliated against, or they're just not ready. St. Thomas Aquinas says that grace builds on nature. And if their nature is in a state of disconnect from God, in a state of mortal sin, you pray for them, it will have some effect. But you end up causing more harm oftentimes than good. So that's one of the things. One of the analogies I use is that there's a television show called My 600-Pound Life. And in that show, you have to they take a person who weighs more than 600 pounds and they go to a bariatric surgeon. They have to lose 200 pounds first. One, it makes their bodies able to receive a surgery. They're healthier. They're under a certain weight threshold where the surgery will actually work, but also to lose that kind of weight, they have to reorder their lives to be able to sustain the healing of the surgery. So they have to have a diet, a formed habit of diet and exercise, formed over the course of 6-8 months to a year to get the weight down. And so that's kind of it's a very good principle on the natural level to explain why there has to be some work done up front on behalf of the person. They've got to get their soul back in shape, their humanity reordered, their sleep schedule ordered before we move out of that particular phase. And we're finding that the regimen, and talk to any monk and they're going to tell you that the regimen is as important as the prayers themselves. The discipline of the prayer life in a monastery is as important as the actual psalms being prayed. So the discipline lays the foundation for the rest of the spiritual life. And so therefore the discipline, by analogy, the discipline in the first phase lays the foundation for a more effective ministry or work of liberation down the road.
When do they move to phase number two? Okay, so phase number one, 30 days of a prayer protocol that's very monastic, very intense. Let's say the person continues showing diabolical affliction. They go to Dr. Dan Schneider, the case facilitator. When do you move on to phase two?
Usually it's a set 30 straight days, and it might take them several resets to get there. A lot of people want, oftentimes, like all of us, we just want a quick fix. We don't want to do the discipline necessary. So the first phase is, you know, you've got a shoulder injury or whatever injury, a hand injury, and you have to go to the physical therapist and you got to work the dumb rubber bands or the rubber ball for a long time to get the little smaller muscles in place so that you can do healing on the larger muscles, which are truly the ones most effective. So that 30 days may last and may take several months, or they may look elsewhere, try other models, try to self-medicate, and then come back a year later. But after, so at some point between 30 days and a year, 2 years, they'll come back. And after they've completed the 30 days, then you shift things a little bit and start focusing in the second section or phase on looking for obstacles to grace, anything that's blocking grace. You're looking to unleash grace, specifically sacramental grace, in their lives. So, you know, as married people, and most of our cases are married, it's through the sacrament of marriage, through our spouses, that grace flows to us. And so helping to reorder things in the home, and the whole home should be praying these prayers together, not just the person who's afflicted, but husband, wife, any you know, the children who've been baptized, you know, over the age of baptism, age of reason. I mean, over the age of reason, if they're baptized and make their first communion, they should be doing the prayers in a limited degree. So the whole house praying together, and it's and then that's after getting more help. That more that people pray, the more people construct. What people don't understand is that oftentimes somebody who's being afflicted, you know, they're God is, and it's hard for us to understand this, but God looks down and he sees a family that has disorder, that has problems. And so he looks and he allows any at all manifestation or any evidence of the presence of evil is allowed by God. It's not like, you know, the teacher is away and there's no teacher in the classroom and the kids are going wild. That's not the way it works. God is allowing this for a salvific purpose, and that is to heal, to heal the whole family. And oftentimes it's the person who is afflicted is not the soul that's most in danger. So when we're looking and talking to the people who are struggling and suffering, we're thinking in the back of our minds, we listen to them tell the story at the first, what happened, what's going on. Who is God really trying to heal? Oftentimes it's the father, the mother, a child in the family. You know, oftentimes the marriage itself is being afflicted so as to cause this division between the husband and wife and stop the flow of grace down to the children. So we're looking at, you know, who is afflicted, what soul is most in danger.
Got it.
And so then,
okay.
Yeah. And
I got a lot of questions for you, Dan. So now we're on phase two. You're trying to help them reorder the home, the prayer life, their family life. How long is that, and when do they move to phase three?
Well, there's one of the Benedictine mottos is peace, and often in the symbolism, the ancient understanding of this peace, and some of the more traditional presentations of Pax, the Latin peace, one of the Benedictine motto of peace, there's a crown of thorns around it. To signify that true peace only comes through uniting one's suffering with the sufferings of Christ. And so this is what is that Catholics misunderstand and overlook is the value of suffering. And so in the second phase, the person is referred to as a penitent, but it's an interior disposition that begins that the person must come to on their own, in their own time and space, and realize, yes, I was a victim of this or that, but I also have been a participant in sin throughout my life. I'm not in a state of grace, or I've lived largely in, outside of grace, outside of the protection of the grace of the sacraments, and so I participated. And so teaching others to start offering their suffering, just like this Benedictine model of Pax with the crown of thorns around it. So embracing and uniting one's suffering with the sufferings of Christ is very, very important to move. This is what moves the needle in the second phase, and it might take months or longer for that to happen.
Listening to Dr. Dan Schneider, Jesse Romero, Jesus 911, we're talking about Linda Blair knocking at the door of Dr. Dan Schneider. How does he move her from being diabolically afflicted all the way to being healed at the end? We'll be right back. Hi, this is Jesse Romero from the Terry and Jesse Show, also from Jesus 911. Let's face it, we all need to use the internet, but we need screen accountability. Why? Pornography is a huge problem, especially on the internet. And every time we tap into the internet, we get bombarded with images and temptations that degrade our humanity. So we need Covenant Eye to block these pornographic sites and advertisements from infiltrating our lives. Covenant Eyes helps us take custody of our eyes and custody of our intellect. So I recommend you go to CovenantEyes.com and type in the promo code VMPR to support the network. Protect yourself and your family from the imminent threats on the internet.
www.covenanteyes.com. Can the baby hear me? How did the baby get in there?
Wow, a pregnancy can sure generate a lot of questions. But what's important is that a baby is a baby, inside and out of the womb. Not just after birth, but 9 months before, at conception.
That's right. Every baby is a miracle. Hello, my name is Marianne Kuharski. I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America. If you know someone who is pregnant or in need of alternatives or assistance, or would like to support the work of Pro-Life Across America, please visit our website at prolifeacrossamerica.org, or better yet, simply dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword pro-life. Pro-Life Across America is non-political and totally educational.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow, that's 80%. RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Jesus 911. If this call is not an emergency, dial 888-526-2151.
Love God, save soul, slay air, Jesus 911, two-man car, soul patrol. We are talking about taking a person who's diabolically afflicted and basically ministering him to the person all the way to the actual, to a final exorcism. We got Dr. Dan Schneider just basically going through all the steps with us. We're on step number two. Dan, it could take months. We're on step number two. You're trying to reorder the home, catechesis, trying to shore up their marriage, catechizing them on redemptive suffering, making sure their prayer life is a strong prayer life is in place. Let's say now they're ready to move to phase number three. What is phase number three? Who determines that?
Well, I don't want to go too quickly into phase three. We always want to rush into phase three, but the real redemptive work is taking place in phase two. So let me flesh out a little bit further, okay? Because phase three, things shift radically, but the foundation is laid in phase two. So at this phase, Think of the angelic salutation or angelic prayer of Fatima, that the angels taught the three children in Fatima to pray this prayer. My God, I believe, I adore, I trust, and I love thee, and I ask pardon for those who do not believe, do not adore, do not trust, and do not love thee. Mm. This is a precursor a couple decades prior to Sister or Saint Faustina in the Divine Mercy revelation. But also the Blessed Mother says in Fatima, many souls go to hell because there are none to sacrifice themselves and to pray for them. So learning to pray and offer your suffering, the soul, any soul who's afflicted, not just people that are heavily afflicted, but learning to offer sacrifices. This is one of the main messages of the apparitions of the Blessed Mother, the proved apparitions of the last century, offering your prayer, your sufferings and sacrifices up for others. You know, we differentiate between atonement and reparation. Atonement is offering sacrifice up for ourselves, for our own sins, filling the cup of the cup of God's justice, so to speak. We receive his mercy, but we owe God the satisfaction, the temporal satisfaction due to our sins. This is straight from the catechism. So we offer suffering up for our own past participation in sin, but also in reparation. This is the message of Fatima, offering up our prayers in reparation for the sins of the world, sins of the church, the conversion of sinners. In this case, looking at the soul and the familial construct that's most in danger, and offering up your suffering for that person. It might even be offering up for the person who abused you, you know, who physically, sexually, or whatever abused you. When you offer up your suffering for that person, the redemptive sacrifice, the grace, is tremendous. It's tremendous. And Our Lady spoke of this many times at Fatima. So this takes time, because the emotional wound and the psychological break that is there because of what the suffering that they've done, this wound that they've received, it takes time for them to work through that. And oftentimes there's psychological counseling taking place at the same time, concurrent with us, because the human and the human and the spiritual are intertwined. There's a symbiotic relationship between the afflicting demon and the broken psychology of the individual. Practically speaking, we try to encourage a weekly confession to start, because as your mind, as you get freed up from as you grow in purity, because what is one of the threefold effects of sin according to the catechism? A darkening, a twofold effect. It darkens the intellect and weakens the will. So when you get the soul, must be returned to the state of grace. In phase one, we're not even going there yet. They've got to get ordered on the interior life. And then once they're properly ordered, now we start looking at a weekly confession to really start pounding away. And as memories begin to emerge that are like, oh my gosh, I forgot. I've never confessed that. I'm still holding on to this unforgiveness, there's some resentment, some anger that keeps coming back. So going deeper into the confession every week. And then a third element, so really it's really threefold in this phase that comes out of this, by using like our freedom through Christ, is a great workbook that we used, that you can buy online, the Freedom Through Christ. It's very helpful. And then the third element is the prayer, starting introducing the rosary. If they don't pray the rosary, introduce it here.
That's
because
like phase
we need
two,
to,
right?
And phase two. Because they need to start, meditatio. They have to learn custody of the intellect, and it's done through meditation. And just the control of the intellect. Teresa of Avila, doctor of the church, says that meditation is the basic form of prayer. There's never a time that her sisters should cease vocal prayer, which lays the foundation for meditation. So learning to control the intellect, how to wield the rosary and pray it prayerfully, so they can start to differentiate between their own interspeak, their own self-speech,
and their demons,
projected speech, and then their own communication with God. We're all communicating on the same channel. So learning custody of the intellect is important for us, so we can recognize when we're getting diabolical or unholy temptations or projections. It's very important for all Christians, not just the afflicted, but everyone needs to learn how to control their emotions and control their thought process, so their emotions aren't being their thoughts aren't being manipulated by projected emotions, either broken emotions or diabolically utilized projections. So these three things.
Let's assume all that happens.
Prayer.
Let's assume all that happens.
Okay.
Now they move on to phase three. What is phase three?
Phase three now, the soul's, the assumption is the soul's got their life ordered to prayer. They've gotten rid of, also in phase two, you've gotten rid of any ties to evil. You know, grandpa, great-grandpa's Masonic ring and apron or Bible, you've gotten rid of all that stuff, all the dream catchers in the house, anything that is emblematic and used in evil, whether knowingly or unknowingly, things of the past, get rid of all that stuff. Focus, reordering your life so your home is a reflection of your interior life, which is oriented towards God. It's a Catholic home and it's a Catholic soul. And then if it continues and they're starting to show signs, often, I mean, just tell you, most people self-liberate in phase two, the large percentage of it. People that grind out this disciplined prayer and they do these things, often, most cases will self-deliver. I've seen it many, many times. But there are certain times that you need the assistance of the church, where there's an institutional element of evil. It seems to be, practically speaking, functionally speaking, from working in the ministry, there needs to be a requisite institutional response of the church. And what do I mean? Somebody who was more than heavily involved in witchcraft, oftentimes you might need some ritual prayer of the church. And this is what we look at in phase three. So then we go deeper into, we do a workup an intake form. They go over, and they're starting to make connections between what's going on. Now that we work with their parish priest, who ideally has been hearing their confession, and we're accompanying and offering assistance to the parish priest. We're not doing this independent at all. We're doing it under the authority of the local bishop and the mandated exorcist, but then in union with the parish priest as consultants to show him what prayers, assisting him on what prayers, severing prayers. And this is where the work of normal deliverance takes place, which is different than exorcism. Exorcism is, that's phase four, we'll get to that. But deliverance is now, some deliverance prayers are being introduced to supplement what is happening in the confessional.
Got it. And so the person in phase three is probably already living in a state of grace at this point, right?
If they're not in a state of grace, they're not in phase three. They got to maintain a state of grace.
Okay, so phase three, they're living in a state of grace. Again, they're working with their parish priest. They're firing their weekly confession. Their life is pretty much in order. Their house is in order. The parish priest is taught deliverance prayers, what he should be doing as well. Let's just say they're doing all this, Dan, and the diabolical affliction, the signs of what St. Charles Borromeo called possession, they're still present. Now we move them on to phase four. What is phase four?
Yeah, if it lingers here, it takes it. You can't move into the fourth phase. Would be possession, which is extremely rare. Usually, when someone comes and says, "I'm possessed. I need a priest," it's normally psychological. It's a sign. It's a warning sign that there's a heavy psychological component. So the third phase, you're doing deliverance prayers. What's called chapter three, or the Leonine prayer, which is a prayer that only priests can pray, and only priests that have the authority of the local bishop to pray. It's the prayer that of Pope Leo to St. Michael against the fallen angels. It's a very effective prayer, but there's others. There's other ancient prayers. St. Cyprian, there's a prayer attributed to St. Cyprian and others. Very ancient deliverance prayers that are very effective. So you mentioned there's three signs of, you have to have certitude of preternatural or supernatural diabolic affliction. And so if you don't have these signs, you can't have certitude for the rite of exorcism. It's not just done all the time. It's very rare. And this is when the priest, after consultation with the pastor, the exorcist, and consulting with the pastor, also consult with a medical professional and to determine, is this psychological? If there's a psychological explanation, you've exhausted every other resource, then you can look at potentially moving someone into possession, treatment for possession, full possession.
Okay, so when is it determined that they're a case of possession? Who makes that determination?
Usually it takes several months, if not over, a year. The medical model starts with the principle of do no harm. And similarly here, you could jump into the chapter three or the Leonine prayer, and do more harm than good because the soul's not in a state of grace. I've seen it many times. Mm-hmm. So you're using the prayer of the church commensurate with the level of affliction, but you don't walk in because you've got cancer or I need heart surgery because I have heart pain. Well, let's first do a checkup and you work through, and let's work on your diet. Let's try to do it as naturally as possible. So because possession is a very serious, exorcism is a very serious prayer. And so there must be signs of preternatural activity that is provable and seen by other people. The other people witness these things as well. So, it's not just I hear voices, because you can hear voices and they can have a perfectly psychological explanation. So until that is determined and you're working with an expert in the medical field as well, who has done an assessment of them, where you can determine that this person, it's again very rare, 3 to 5% probably of cases actually move into the rite of exorcism. Yeah.
So who makes that determination? Is it the priest or priest in consultation with the medical doctor or the therapist?
Well, there has to be a medical doctor assessment. And then there's an official form that is, or a letter that is written to the bishop requesting, and the exorcist has assessed the situation, looked at the medical evaluation. He's looked at and spoken with the pastor who's done deliverance prayers and to some effect. But they're just stuck, and they've determined that this is a case of possession. And then they petition the bishop, will write a letter authorizing the rite of exorcism. And once that starts, you're committed. It's game on. You stay with that soul until you're liberated.
Got it. You're listening to Dr. Dan Schneider. He's walking us through somebody basically petitioning the church all the way to the very end. If this is a bona fide case. And I got a lot of questions to ask Dr. Dan. Very good information that most Catholics have probably never heard. We'll be right back. Two-man car. Don't go away.
Help the Helpless, a Minnesota St. Paul nonprofit organization chaired by Father of Tyr and volunteers, is humbly asking you for your kind support to help the poor and the handicapped children in India and Ecuador. Through financial support from the Help of the Helpless benefactors, the children are provided with clothing, food, education, shelter, and the teachings of the Catholic Church. The mission is to help children thrive and become self-sufficient young adults leading productive lives. We also provide aid to poor families in Ecuador with food baskets, medicines, medical assistance, and help with funeral needs for the deceased. The work in India is done by Father Antonio's organization, St. Mary's. In Ecuador, the work is being done by the Servant Sisters of the Home of Mother. You can call us at 877-762-8857. To learn more, please visit our website, www.helpthehelpless.org. God bless you.
If you shop on Amazon.com, there's an easy way to support Virgin Most Powerful Radio. Just visit smile.amazon.com and type in Catholic Resource Center under the desired charity. Now, when you log into your Amazon account and purchase products, a portion of it will automatically go to support Virgin Most Powerful Radio at no cost to you. Thanks in advance for supporting CRC and VMPR, and may God richly bless you and your family.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Jesus 911. If this call is not an emergency, dial 888-526-2151.
Back to Jesus 911, Dr. Nash Schneider. My name is Jesse Romero.
We had the rapture here for a minute. I got the sign. If this mic is unmanned, I've been raptured.
You thought I was part of the Left Behind series, right?
I thought so. Hey, so the signs you're looking for, they're written out in what's called the Praenotundra of the rite of exorcism.
So what are they?
What's that?
Yeah. So what are they?
Attributed to St. Charles Borromeo. One is aversion to the sacred. And so someone says, I get nauseous, I vomit at the consecration. I get nervous walking into the church. You start to see little signs, but this is so oftentimes like even the touch of something, they can tell the difference between something blessed and unblessed. You can put holy water out and regular tap water out, and they can say, yeah, this one's blessed. They can sense if there's if the exorcist is in town or not. They know if the bishop's traveling or not. They can tell if the exorcist is in the church. You know, I've had them say, oh, Father's not here today, is he? Well, how did you know that? I don't know. You know, the old saying we say is not what you know, it's how you know it. So aversion to the sacred, supernatural strength. You know, I've seen a 14, 15-year-old, 110-pound girl bend metal objects, bend a ring into an oblong shape by squeezing it, push 8 men off her, that sort of thing, supernatural strength. And the third is knowledge beyond one's – occult knowledge or knowledge beyond one's state, speaking languages that you're versed in, perfect understanding of Latin, that sort of thing. So those are three – three generic – categories.
Perfect understanding of Latin when you're a high school dropout.
Yeah. Or speaking Spanish during a session, and someone in a session speaks Spanish. I've had that, you know, somebody speaking Spanish in a very nasty voice, and then I start talking to them in Spanish afterwards, and they look at me like, oh, I don't speak Spanish, bro. Oh, okay. So, you know, those are signs those are some of the preternatural signs.
Got it.
You know, I've seen people put, say, you know, Saint Benedict crucifix that's been blessed, according to the old rite, the old ritual blessing, and placed upon their body, and it burns and leaves a burn mark. You know, that doesn't normally happen, you know, so we're looking for those sorts of things. And then upon consultation with the medical professional, because we cannot make the mistake of treating something as diabolic when it's psychological. We have to exhaust all natural means first before you conclude. The mistake that I've made and others have made is we assume that everything is just, oh my gosh, yeah. And we start, and the demon just runs you down rabbit holes. You have to be very methodical and cautious. You know, one of the principles, for example, dealing with Marian apparitions, the church's position on mystical phenomena in general seen in Marian apparitions is open but cautious. You know, is this particular apparition or mystic, is this true? The church is open but cautious. And that's a general principle for mystical phenomenon. It's a good principle for us to apply in our own spiritual lives. Be open but cautious. And so when dealing with the diabolic and you're looking for preternatural signs, open but cautious. Be very cautious. Don't rush in. It takes a long time. Do not get into a hurry because the person is in a frantic state oftentimes, and they just want fixed. And it's not that easy. It just takes time. Healing takes time. You know, you have a deep surgery on a heart or a knee rebuild or a broken bone. It just takes time. And there's a process you have to go through so that the body can heal. Well, so too our souls. Our souls have been damaged. Our soul has been heavily afflicted in this particular case of someone who's possessed. It just takes time. At the end of the day, though, it's the prayer of the church weighing down upon the diabolic. At this point, we believe that the demon is bound there and will suffer tremendous punishment at the hands of the exorcist, and will leave only when God has determined that all the grace has been mined out of the situation. The demon has been punished for afflicting the child of God. The soul is in a state of grace and is safe to be liberated. The grace is poured into their family. And so there's a lot of factors on determining why. Sometimes it takes a long, long time. some, you know, there's been exorcists that have prayed for years over people, and it just takes time. There's a lot of factors. You're dealing with complex issues, mystical issues, a lot of speculation involved, and the human person is a complex being, imbued with a spiritual nature. So it just takes time. It's not a quick fix. It's not a one and done by any means.
Got it. So Dan, who's the one that, when is a person actually scheduled for a session of exorcism prayers? When that would be after phase four, who's the one that schedules them, and how do you prepare the energumen for the session? So I asked you three questions there.
Every exorcist is going to have his own style, his own way of communication, just like every priest. You know, your own parish priest communicates. Do you want to talk to Father? He wants you to call him on a cell phone. Another priest says, don't call me on a cell phone unless it's an emergency. Email me. Another one says, go to my secretary. She keeps my calendar. So, you know, oftentimes the exorcist is very busy, so he'll let the administration go back to a deacon or a lay team member who's a coordinating the ministry for him in the diocese, and they'll say, okay, Father, we've moved this person. You've moved this person into the fourth phase. We're going to do exorcism. Here's the workup. We're documented everything over the last 18 months, all the work we've done. This is, we think, entry points. This is where we think the holding point is. This is where we think the attachments are. This is what's been blown out through by the parish priest, through deliverance prayers. This is what we think is remaining. Here's your, basically your chart. What do you want to do? Okay, let's order a session, and let's arrange a session. So you arrange a session. You, whatever team members have gotten that are working under the mandated exorcist, so they're protected. You say, we're on Tuesday night, we're meeting at this church. Because it's secluded, it's quiet, it's out of the way. Obviously, all activity should be on holy ground. You're not meeting in people's houses and public places. It's only on holy ground, sacred ground. And so, and then you'll meet according to whatever the dictate of the exorcist is, and he'll tell you when to meet, and you'll get there maybe 30 minutes early or whatever, and do some prayers, that sort of thing. Get ready for it.
What about the energumen? How do you prepare him for, let's say, you're coming on Tuesday night? Father's going to pray over you, the rite. What do you tell him? I mean, you don't say, hey, well, right before you come, go to In-N-Out and have a double-double. I mean, what do you tell the energumen?
Yeah. Obviously, the state of grace is absolutely essential. You got to stay in a state of grace. Go to confession to your pastor. Ideally, the pastor is present, because now you've got two layers of spiritual authority on the person, with the person. You've got the mandated exorcist who has the mandated authority from the local ordinary, and also the pastor who has pastoral authority, spiritual authority as pastor. That's the ideal situation, and the priest are working in tandem. They oftentimes will even take turns on some of the prayers, but if not, the parish priest will just stay and pray. But getting someone in a state of grace and getting them to shore them up, hey, just ignore any projections, do the best you can to fight through it. You're going to get 1,000 excuses on why you should, you know, you and I get resistance to go exercise. You know, you and I've talked about this. I don't want to work out today, but you do it. You fight through it because your fallen nature is lazy, and we're all lazy. And so spiritually, when there's an afflicting, possessing demon, they're going to be sending all sorts of roadblocks against us, against the soul, to keep from coming and showing up at that session. They always have to bring a family member with them to assist. And different priests have different protocols. So it all kind of varies a little bit, but they need someone that drives them there and takes them there and is present as witness to it as well.
Dan, so where's the team sitting or standing or kneeling? But how many people are on the average team? Is there a team leader? And like, where do you situate them? I mean, do you put them like, you know, is it like the testudo position? I mean, what do you do? You know, do you put them like Spartans around the person, or do you have them on their knees? What's the preference?
Yeah, it just depends. It's up to the exorcist. It's his decision. He's the general. Christ is the exorcist. Our Lady is the commander of angels. Saint Michael is always present and exercising his power and his mission in life, or his mission in the heavenly realm for us. So it just depends if the person if it becomes kind of violent. Sometimes you might need some help there with the person, but otherwise the people sit in the back and pray. if they sit in the church and pray and the priest does his prayers, with maybe one assistant holding the book and one person there or two people there present to make sure, you know, that everything is safe.
So does the energumen, do they usually sit? Is that the right?
Yeah, sometimes they sit, sometimes they lay. It just depends on, you know, you're dealing with St. Thomas says that that each angel is its own species. So there's really no predicting what's going to happen. So, but these things pattern out. And so ideally they sit, but sometimes they can't remain sitting and they lay down. But you just want to make sure that they're not in a position where they can have any kind of projected self-harm, you know, bang in the head, that sort of thing.
Got it. So you said that usually the team's there about 30 minutes before. And obviously the team has to be in a state of grace. I mean, that goes without saying. They have to be, probably have to, as they say, churched up and prayed up and sacramented up before they get there.
So, because confess as close as possible to the date, be in a state of grace, fasting, especially on those days and days prior, as fasting is very important. It's a brutal, thing on the team members, even more so on the priest. So you just understand your role, stay in your lane. We're here to support the priest and whatever assignments he gives us, and we offer our own suffering up for this particular case. Just as we're telling, hey, you need to offer your suffering up for liberation. We got to practice what we preach, and we have to. Anyone participating in this should be, should be doing penance. So it doesn't have to be anything great. You know, what was the Curé des Arts said? The patron saint of parish priest about the confessional. He says, be a lion in a pulpit and a lamb in the confessional. Give a slight penance and do the rest yourself. This is the Curé des Arts advice to priests. So for lay people, it's similarly, we're entering into the stream of a very mystical thing. We're dealing with the mystery of a soul that is being purified and brought back to Christ. And so it's a tender, beautiful experience.
Got it. Jesus 911, Dr. Dan Schneider, Jesse Romero. Dr. Schneider's walking us from beginning to end the rite of exorcism. We'll be right back.
Hands on Apologetics, you have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo, where we go wall to wall with defending, explaining, sharing the faith. Master Apologist Carlo Broussard. Carlo, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Hey, Gary, it's great to be back in the dojo, my friend.
Master Apologist Ken Hensley, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Good to see you again, Gary. Good to be with you.
Michael Barber, welcome. You have entered into the Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo.
Gary, thanks for having me on.
We are chatting with Master Apologist Carl Keating.
Gary, it's great to be back with you.
Coming into the dojo is our good friend Steve Ray.
Thank you, Gary. Good to be here.
Tim Staples, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Gary. Thanks for having me on.
Join many others in Gary Machuda's Apologetics Dojo.
We have some of the best Catholic apologists in the nation.
Streaming live weekdays from 10 to 11 a.m. Pacific. Hands-on Apologetics on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Jesus said in Luke 17, "When you have done all that you were ordered to do, say, 'We are unprofitable servants. We have only done our duty.'" According to St. John of the Cross, God is pleased with the little deeds we do in secret. He takes more pleasure in these than in a multitude of grand works that we may do out of the desire to be seen by others. May God help us to do the things that please Him, and not just to appear great in the eyes of others.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE,
US 1.
Now, back to Jesus 911. If this call is not an emergency, dial 888-526-2151.
Love God, save soul, slay error. Jesus 911, two-man car, Dr. Dan Schneider, Jesse Romero. Just, we're talking about taking a person who is a petitioner, now he's now a penitent, and now he's an actual case. He's an actual energumen. So, Dan, when the prayer starts, does the priest pray chapter 2 before he prays chapter 3, or does it matter? Second question, should he pray in English or in Latin? Does it matter? Third question, how long does it take to pray chapter 2 and chapter 3, the whole thing? What's the duration of going through chapter 2 and 3? So I hit you with three questions.
Yeah, precision is very important, and nowhere. Now, sometimes there are moments that the priest can go extemporaneous, and if he senses something and goes after something, but otherwise he follows the rubric. You know, that the old saying: do what's in red, say what's in black. You know, do the red. So it starts off. He actually starts at the beginning. At the very first one, he'll do this. It's an announcement. A priest, one who is expressly and in a special wise authorized by the ordinary, when he intends to perform an exorcism over persons tormented by the devil, must be properly distinguished for his piety, prudence, and integrity of life. And this goes for anyone who's involved in this: piety, prudence, and integrity of life. He should fill this devout undertaking in all constancy and humility, being utterly immune to any striving for human aggrandizement and relying not on his own but on the divine power. Moreover, he ought to be of mature years, revered not alone for his office but his moral quality. So so the very first time, the opening, he'll read this, and then after that, they'll go right into the rite in future times. And you just start. You know, you can see the black, the red. Do the black. You know, do the black, read the red, and they'll read it. I'm using the old ritual here. So, chapter 2 comes before chapter 3. Everything's done in its order. And then it can be in Latin or English. So the only approved English translation is the new ritual, which came out about 10 years ago, which was a pretty different from the old ritual. So most priests find the old ritual more effective. And so they use the old ritual, but it's only approved one for this country is the new ritual in English. So most priests either use that or they use the old ritual in Latin.
So,
and what was the third question?
You answered it. Is it in English or in Latin? What's the difference between doing it in English or in Latin? In your study, your opinion, what you've observed on the field?
Yeah, Latin is much more effective. The prayers themselves, but also the Latin language. It's the language, the official language of the church. I've seen multiple snickers. Again, I'm the observer, the cap scout on the team, and whenever a priest or whoever's doing this mispronounces a Latin word, you'll see snickers and that sort of thing. You know,
the demon, right?
So, but the demon, yeah. So, yeah. The Latin language and the old ritual is, in my observation, is more effective, and I think that's kind of the general opinion among exorcists. But there are those who would say the new ritual is just as good. It's just not as effective. It's just the words themselves, the prayers themselves. There's no imprecatory prayers. It's more liturgical and communal. And the old one is. It's the old saying. The saying that I've heard is the old rite is a weapon disguised as a liturgy, and so it's a heavy weapon, and the new one is more liturgical, disguised as a weapon, so to speak. So but it's up to the priest. It's up to the exorcist's choice. But the Latin, in my observation, is more effective. The ancient languages, that were put on the cross, and Greek, Hebrew, and Latin. Those languages are ancient, and particularly the Latin language, because it's the language of the church. So it's more effective, I think, And the demon recognizes it more because this is the language that's been used against them from the beginning, at least since the church's institution as a Latin-speaking church. And then the third question was, how long does it take? Usually, I think it takes about 20, 25 minutes, depending on the priest and how good his Latin is, how many times he's done it. But 20, 25 minutes, and it's good to do maybe three cycles. So it takes about 20 minutes to cycle through one time.
To cycle through chapter two and three, correct?
Through the whole ritual.
Okay.
The whole rite takes 20 minutes. Yeah, including all the chapters. There's a lot of psalms that are being read, that sort of thing, and some direct imprecatory prayers. Yeah. So it takes about 20 minutes, and it's good to cycle through three times just to see what kind of reaction you get.
And of course, you give the person a prig because I mean they're going through a physical and torment and mental torment. So the priest is going to give them a break after he cycles through one time, talks to them, gives them some water, probably ask them some questions before he cycles again, correct?
If they're cognizant, yes. But otherwise,
yeah, if they're cognizant.
Most of the time, if you're there, they're probably not. If you're at this point, they're probably not cognizant.
Got it. So what reactions can you expect from the energumen? And let me just mention, Father Forte in his book, he writes that, here's what he says. There are two principal types of demons that cause two distinct types of possession, the Clausi and the Aperti. He says, a Clausi's demon causes the possessed to close his eyes with them rolled back when entering into a trance. An Apertus demon causes the possessed to keep his eyes open while in a trance, giving looks of anger and rage and speaking a great deal. The Aperti are loquacious and violent, and the possessed person often needs to be held down during the exorcism. The Clausi will speak after some time of prayer, always without opening their eyes, but others are completely mute. Then he says, the Abditi, which means hidden or secret, the Abditi demons are those that hide in the interior of the possessed person without showing themselves in any way, and the person notices the change in his life and feels strange things that make him suspect, there's an external force that has entered him. He can't even experience preternatural phenomenon. But when the priest prays, the demon resists and gives no sign of being present. In some cases, Abditi demons have been able to resist 2 hours of exorcism without giving the least sign of their presence. And after much insistence, the demon can resist and cannot resist any longer and shows himself in all his rage and with all the signs that often appear in possession. He says, the Abditi demons are not a distinct type of demon. They're simply demons who hide themselves within the person. He says, but the two main demons that you have, he says, that are forced to reveal themselves, they will act like the Clausi or the Aperti demons. Again, Clausi are the ones, he says, causes the possessed to close their eyes or have them roll them back and puts them in a trance. The Aperti keeps the eyes open while in a trance and gives looks of anger and rage and speaks a great deal. What's been your in the field? What have you seen more? What's more common?
It's a great mystery. So I think it's about the same. I think it just depends on what you're dealing with. And it's not just, and remember, you're not dealing with just one, you're dealing with a cluster or, you know, so they're going to have, just like in a physical battle, you're going to have different troops and different types playing their part, you know, and same thing in a spiritual battle, you're going to have different forces and different types will cycle in and out throughout that session. So it's not just one or the other. It's kind of a both and it all kind of depends. It's a great mystery, you know. I think the big thing is to not to focus on the phenomenon, some of the external stuff, and just focus on praying for the soul, for the liberation, for the restoration to, you know, through the church, to the restoration to God the Father through Christ. You know, the big thing is not being drawn into the, you know, any kind of stuff that may or may not happen. It's just to focus on the soul, praying for the soul, praying your prayer assignment, praying for the priest, etc.
Dan, three questions. Who suffers more from demonic possession, men or women?
It's possession. Phenomenon de facto in the field out here that it's normally more women seem to come to the ministry, but of interest since the COVID, there's been a lot more. There's been an influx of men for some reason. I don't know why, but it's a mystery. But I think women are more vulnerable in many ways. Just we know in the physical realm, look at just say, STD statistics, how women's nature, their bodily nature is more vulnerable to STDs than men. So too in the spiritual realm, there's some mystery there of the vulnerability of women. Maybe it's the openness. Maybe it's it could be a lot of things. I don't know. I can't really speculate on it. But yeah, it seems to be more women than men. Even that kind of cycles through in various parts of the country and various teams.
Dan, where do you see more violent manifestations, with men or with women, or maybe equal or both?
I think it just depends. I think it's kind of equal. But by and large, a larger majority of cases are women. But yeah, they can be. But that doesn't mean that they can't get, rather animated.
One last question before we wrap it up for today. Great show, by the way. When does a priest know when to end the session? And then what should the team do right after an ergman leaves? What should be done?
Yeah, beforehand, the priest gives assignments to everybody, praying for, infrastructure, praying for the soul, praying for the person, praying for the priest, praying for any of the lay people that are be closer to the person. You'd have different assignments. And then afterwards, the priest makes the decision. You kind of have to watch, very sensitive to the you don't want to quit early, but you don't want to push so far that you're causing any harm to the person physically or. So usually, you should get out of there in an hour or so and not let it prolong, because this is a long, fall into the temptation of, we got to get this done and get it out of here. It just takes time. You're accompanying a soul in a major place in their life. And so the priest makes the decision. Yeah, we're just going to do one cycle today, and we're going to stop. Or he'll say, I'm going to get through three cycles today. I'm going to do one cycle of this, and I'm going to do this particular deliverance prayer because I think this is more effective because of this or that nature, the curses or whatever. So that he could do that as well. But the priest calls it. The person goes. He gives, and then afterwards, like any battle, you discuss anything you that was projected, anything that you saw or heard, and then. The priest usually does a infilling prayer for the person, and then prayers against retaliation again for the team and the priest.
Got it. Thanks, Dr. Dan Schneider. You've been listening to Jesus 911. Jess Romero, your host, and we've been talking about Catholic spiritual warfare, taking a person from basically the very beginning when they knock at the church's door all the way to the very end, to the rite of exorcism. And thanks, Dan Schneider, for providing some good intel for the body of Christ. Up next, Gary Machuda, hands-on apologetist, coming from the Midwest Command Center. But yeah, two men here that love the Lord, love Our Lady, faithful to Holy Mother Church. We're signing off for 10-7. We're out of service. See you next time, same Christ channel. God bless you. Keep the faith. If you like what you hear, then like us and share this show with others. See you next time. We're out.
St. Faustina's Prayer for Priests. O my Jesus, I beg thee on behalf of the whole Church, grant it love and the light of thy Spirit, and give power to the words of priests, so that hardened hearts might be brought to repentance and return to thee, O Lord. Lord, give us holy priests. Thou thyself maintain them in holiness. O divine and great High Priest, may the power of thy mercy accompany them everywhere and protect them from the devil's traps and snares, which are continually being set for the souls of priests. May the power of thy mercy, O Lord, shatter and bring to naught all that might tarnish the sanctity of priests. For thou canst do all things. Amen. Virgin most powerful, pray for us.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.